ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to Animal Concerns of Texas, ACT Radio. I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, entertainment, and clothing, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also talk about the impact to the environment of a meat-based diet and how a plant-based diet is much kinder to the world.
So if you're concerned about the environment, the animals, or your health, stick around for ACT Radio.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Jamie Karpovich, who does a blog and a vegan television show. That's coming up a little later, but first some news.
Environmental Health News reports newborn fish exposed to hormone-laden manure from Indiana farms were much more likely to be male than those raised in uncontaminated water, according to new research. The findings add evidence that farm runoff may alter fish hormones and affect their reproduction and development. Purdue University researchers raised fathead minnow embryos in water taken from two Indiana streams that are contaminated with natural and synthetic hormones from manure spread on fields. The embryos turned out 60% male. Fish typically are born with roughly equal numbers of males and females. According to the researchers, over time this skewing toward male fish could drop fish populations. Livestock excrete natural hormones, estrogens and testosterones, as well as synthetic ones used to bolster their growth. Depending on concentrations and fish sensitivities, these hormones and hormone mimics might impair wild fish reproduction or skew their sex ratio. Hormones were found in 80% of the water samples taken at two agricultural streams in central Indiana, compared with no hormones at a nearby creek unexposed to manure runoff. The streams also had 50% less fish diversity and 28% higher adult minnow death rates than the creek with no farm runoff. The manure in the research came from cattle, dairy, pig, and poultry confined in animal feeding operations. Such farms produce between 2,800 tons and 1.6 million tons of manure per year, according to a report by the U.S. Government Accountability Office. Some livestock operations sell manure to nearby farms to fertilize fields, an easy, useful way to get rid of it. However, some of this drains into natural watersheds and causes unintended consequences like skewing sex ratios of fish.
Two big events recently took place in the world of food. The Food and Drug Administration decreed that genetically engineered salmon were safe to eat and wouldn't harm the environment. And second, McDonald's announced that its McRib sandwich is back on the menu. The FDA's announcement paves the way for the first approval of a genetically engineered animal for humans to eat, and it was met with a good deal of criticism by Consumers Union, National Geographic, and many other advocacy groups who are wary of genetically engineered food. The McRib's return was greeted with happy faces on the millions of Americans who eat at one of the 13,000 McDonald's restaurants from Maine to Hawaii every day. If you like salmon, should you worry about the safety of eating genetically engineered salmon? No, says the FDA. The FDA said it could find no valid scientific reason to prohibit the sale of the fish. The genetically altered salmon is Atlantic salmon made from an egg which has been injected with a gene from a Chinook salmon. That gene, which is stuck to a bit of DNA from another fish, the ocean pout, carries instructions for making more growth hormone than an Atlantic salmon ordinarily makes. More growth hormone means faster growth and thus more salmon to eat much more quickly and thus faster profits for the fish industry. If you like the McRib, should you worry about eating it? There is no rib in a McRib. The sandwich features a McRib pork patty, which looks vaguely rib-like and contains nearly a gram of sodium, 26 grams of fat, and 23 milligrams of cholesterol. Americans are offered a mountain of jumbo-sized, salty, fatty food every day. And it's these foods that are killing and disabling them at a very high rate. Making more salmon more cheaply, faster, is a slightly better option than ignoring the crap that too many people are currently eating every day. Those who claim to be worried about what we eat should worry a lot less about people eating genetically engineered salmon and a whole lot more about the number of Americans who eat fast food daily. Those who care about public health should not target bigger fish, but the drive-through. But in declaring genetically modified salmon safe, the FDA ignored a few facts. Farmed fish that escape from net pens may have a significant impact on the surrounding marine ecosystem. They can compete for food with wild fish and take over limited marine habitat areas. Farmed fish can also spread diseases that did not previously exist in wild fish populations. In addition, farmed fish, genetically modified, may interbreed with wild fish and alter the genetic makeup of that species. There have been known cases of millions of genetically modified Atlantic salmon that escaped and traveled thousands of miles from their farms, interbreeding with the wild salmon and disrupting nesting habitats. Fish farming is not only detrimental to the marine ecosystem, but may also pose human health risk. And that's not because the fish were genetically modified. Studies have shown that farmed salmon have 10 times more residues of PCBs and dioxins, cancer-causing chemicals, than wild salmon. This is because feed pellets produced for farmed salmon consist of concentrated fish meal made from wild fish that are most commonly exposed to environmental pollutants. You can't be sure you're really buying wild salmon just because it says so on the label. A study by Consumer Reports found that half of the salmon labeled as wild were really farmed, but labeled as wild to be sold at a higher price. If you think that eating fish is a good idea because of the healthy omega-3 fatty acids, bear in mind that you're also getting an unhealthy dose of pesticides, PCBs, dioxin, and mercury. It's much healthier to get omega-3 from flax seeds and walnuts. It's also cheaper, and the fish will thank you.
In some positive wildlife news, a jaguar and an ocelot were photographed in southern Arizona. An adult male jaguar and an adult male ocelot were photographed in two separate Arizona mountain ranges by automated wildlife monitoring cameras. The images were collected as part of the Jaguar Survey and Monitoring Project led by the University of Arizona. In late November 2012, the U of A project downloaded photos from wildlife cameras set up as part of the research project and found new pictures of a jaguar in the Santa Rita Mountains. A total of 10 jaguar photos were taken by three of the U of A cameras and one Arizona Game and Fish Department camera. The cat's unique spot pattern matched that of a male jaguar in the Whetstone Mountains photographed by a hunter in the fall of 2011, providing clear evidence that the big cats travel between southern Arizona's Sky Island mountain ranges. In addition, a new ocelot photo was taken in the Huachuca Mountains west of Sierra Vista by one of the U of A project cameras. Again, comparisons of the spot patterns reveals this to be the same male ocelot that has been previously reported by the Arizona Game and Fish Department and photographed in the Huachucas several times in 2011 and 2012. However, the U of A photo was taken about 4 miles away from the previous photos, again demonstrating that even smaller cats can move across the rugged Arizona landscape. The ocelot has been protected in the U.S. as endangered under the Endangered Species Act since 1982, while the jaguar was listed in 1997. To learn more about these beautiful endangered cats, visit biologicaldiversity.org.
Coming up next, we feature a conversation with Jamie Karpovich, a lifestyle coach, author of the online blog Save the Kales. Jamie also does a vegan TV cooking show by the same name. So stick around. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Jamie Karpovich. Thanks for being with us on the show, Jamie.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Jamie, could you tell our listeners how you got motivated to become a vegan?
Yeah, well, it's a long story and there's many parts, but the short
good,
version...
Oh, good. We won't have to do a lot of work on the show today.
Well, the short version is when I was in high school, I kind of became part of the punk rock community, if you will, and those were kind of my friends, and a lot of those people were really into all kinds of social justice issues, you know, not just for animals, but of course for people. There were concerns about the environment, and that was really the first time I learned the word vegan. I learned what that was, but I wasn't quite there yet. And then when I was a senior in high school, when I was 17 years old, my dad got sick unexpectedly and passed away. And all of a sudden, the world was kind of seen through these new eyes, and I kind of really related to things dying when maybe they don't need to be dying.
Yeah.
And I became very sensitive to that. So it really was, you know, because of just making this connection between how it feels when something that you love dies when it shouldn't. And I started to think about that in terms of the food I was eating, you know. So all of a sudden, I was looking at food and hamburgers and thinking, like, what if this cow is another cow's dad, you know, and I killed it just because I wanted to eat it. So that was, like, the lens that I saw everything through. And then in the last couple of years, you know, I don't know if this happens with a lot of people. It did happen with me, unfortunately, where some things go on in your life and you kind of let go a lot of the things that are really important to you. And so veganism was something that I wouldn't say that I shunned it after a while. This is years and years later, back after I had graduated from college at this point. I was just going through a really hard time, and I didn't really care about anything. I wasn't vegan anymore. It wasn't like I wasn't like going out and eating steaks every day. Like, I was still a vegetarian, but I just didn't care enough. I had a lot of trouble with anxiety and depression. I let everything go. It breaks my heart now because it's like I can't even imagine that now. But, you know, in trying to help myself get better and just kind of pull myself out of this this really dark place that I think maybe all of us have been to at one time or another.
Oh, sure.
So in trying to get out of that, I started to go back to what I knew and what I loved and what made me feel good, and that was helping animals. And I definitely think that there's a connection between helping animals and caring for animals, which helps you care more about yourself because it raises your consciousness. And yeah, so that was the time that I started my blog, Save the Kales.
Why kale? Was it just so you could make that joke?
Yeah, it was supposed to be like funny, like save the whales,
yeah.
But save the kales, you know, I thought it would be, I wanted it to be something funny and catchy, but kale at that time was like not quite the rock star vegetable that
yeah.
it is right now.
Yeah.
And now it's like everywhere and it's on everything.
Guilty. I feel guilty for not eating it very often.
Oh, really? Yeah, I just had some last night. Yeah, I feel like I have to. People are always coming up to me saying, like, oh, Jamie, I had some 3 days ago. You'd be so proud. So I guess I'm like the kale monitor now.
How long have you been blogging?
I've been blogging for, wow, it'll be 3 years next month.
We'll get back to blogging in a second, but how long
sure.
has your television show been going on?
The show has been airing since May of 2012, so
uh-huh.
a little under a year.
That's great. I think it's terrific that we have so many tools we can use nowadays to get the message out. What you said just a few moments ago reminds me of something you said in one of your blogs, that we talk a lot about veganism, saving animals, but I really
mm-hmm.
think it can help us save ourselves, you said.
Mm-hmm.
And I really related to that. I realized that when I'm advocating, it's even the way I say I'm a vegan, I say I do it because I don't want to be a part in causing misery. So it's about
right.
me. It's about me more than it is saving animals.
It's so connected. I always get a little discouraged when there's that stereotype of, like, the angry vegan, you know, like you know the one, right? Like, we're all, like, out there, like, we just hate everybody, but we're trying to save animals. That's a little disheartening. Don't get me wrong. I've met some people like that.
Yeah,
but,
I have moods like that, but it doesn't
yeah.
happen often, thank God.
Yeah, maybe that's a little part of all of us, but, but yeah, I mean, it really is about, like, doing the best you can, and when you make decisions and when you talk to people, you know, like, I can't go out there and say I'm vegan because I don't want to hurt anybody, but then be a jerk to people, because that's hurting people. You know, it's hurting people's feelings. And so I think being a nice person, a kind person to yourself, to other people, of course, to animals, like, it's all part of the package for me.
Yeah. And we have to set a good example. We can't allow ourselves to let the anger take over.
Exactly, yeah. And you're not, you know, you're not going to win any people that way either.
No.
Jamie, let's go back to your blogging. How effective do you think blogging is? Nowadays, there's so many people blogging. How do you get your blog out there and make sure that people are reading it?
There are so many. I mean, the first thing is just being consistent. So I forget what the statistic is about how many blogs start up every single day. No. But, you know, how many of them actually are still up and running in 6 months? Not a lot. So, you know, blogging, I think it's like a lot of people think, like, oh, I'm just going to write some stuff on the internet, you know, but if you want to actually make it good and make it something that other people want to read, you have to keep up with it. You have to provide interesting content. But also a big part of it, I think, is just being sincere. I think everybody's kind of getting over that whole phase of, like, the blogs where every single thing is perfect and polished and you're so amazing and you're so great. I think a lot of people are starting to really want to see more sincerity, more relatable stuff, which can be sometimes like the hard stuff in your life, or like, you know, you tried to do something good and it didn't quite work out and you're a little vulnerable. I think that vulnerability is almost like the new blogging trend, if you will.
How do you get the word about your blog out there?
Well, I think going out and actually meeting people in real life helps.
So, yeah.
You know, I mean, the online world is great, and there are days when I just want to sit on my couch and like, talk to people on the internet all day. But actually going out and going to community events, I mean, being involved in my community is also really important to me, and I try and do that at every shot that I get, just through different activities or organizations or, like, community events and things like that. So, you know, when people can actually meet you, now they know you, and then when they read your blog, they see you as the human being, like the real-life person, come through in your writing, and I think that makes it more appealing.
You're in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania?
Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, yeah.
Is there a vegetarian society there?
No, Bethlehem, okay, Bethlehem's a little interesting because there's actually, I think, more and more an increasingly larger population of vegetarian and vegan people. We have one of the most well-known vegan bakeries in the whole, literally in the whole world. They actually just won an award for being one of the best bakeries in the world. Vegan Treats Bakery is like a couple blocks away, and, you know, they're amazing. But we don't have, like, we don't actually have a vegetarian restaurant. We don't have one whole area.
We don't know Paso either.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
See, I always meet people, and they're, like, talking about all these crazy restaurants they have, so I assume everybody has them but us. But there are a lot of people, and there are a lot of ways to get involved, and there's potlucks and groups, and there's a lot to do. It's just not quite organized into one big hub. But maybe that's a project to work on.
Let's talk about something else you do. You're a lifestyle coach. How did that come about?
Yes, that is a new development as of just a few months ago. But it's really exciting. Victoria Moran, the wonderful, lovely Victoria Moran.
Main Street Vegan,
yes, and, you know, 8 billion other books. And she's one of the most energetic and charismatic public speakers and human beings I've ever met. She has a course called Main Street Vegan Academy. And you go to this class, and it's about 5 or 6 days in New York City, and you go to her home. And it's just, like, morning till night. I mean, I think I slept maybe 4 or 5 hours a night while I was there.
Wow.
It's morning till night, and she brings in speakers and authors and people in the community and small business owners. And it's, like, veganism intensified, and you learn as much as you can about every topic you can. And upon completing that course, you have a certification that you are a lifestyle coach. And so a lifestyle coach is basically, I mean, it can be anything from, like, somebody saying, I want to veganize all of my makeup that I use. Like, I don't even know where to start. What's good vegan makeup? To people saying, you know, I'm eating a standard American diet. I don't want to do that anymore. I have no clue where to start. So it can be food. It can be health. It can be fitness. It can be products. And it's basically taking your expertise as somebody who does this for years, you know, and helping somebody who may not have the time to, like, read 80 books. So,
yeah,
really working with them one-on-one.
That sounds like a good idea, and it sounds far easier path than becoming a registered dietitian or anything.
Well, and it's fun because it sounds like you have a little support group there that you build up, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, a registered dietitian is awesome, you know, and that's years and years of schooling, and that's definitely a focus on nutrition, and you certainly learn an awful lot. This is, I mean, at least in what I do, this is a little bit more of like a lifestyle thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it might not necessarily be people wanting to know, like, how many grams of protein are in broccoli. It might just be somebody saying, like, I work 60 hours a week and I need some vegan meals that I can keep in my freezer so I can have them when I get home, but I don't know how to cook them. So it's a little more like day-to-day stuff.
Where did you learn about cooking? Did you have a family member that taught you or something?
No, I just started to do it. My dad, who was like not a vegan cook at all, but he loved cooking like weird stuff, and I'll call it weird because it was like how we kind of started to glorify like eating these weird bits of animals now. Like, you know, that was my dad. That's kind of what I grew up with. But basically what that taught me is not to be afraid of trying anything. So when it came to trying some vegan food, you know, like so many people now are like, oh, tofu, that's so weird, you know? Like,
well, sometimes it is.
yeah. I was never afraid of that. So I think I credit my dad to that. And you know, I also credit my mom to, you know, when I was 16 years old and we went out to the grocery store because I got my very first vegan cookbook, and we had to buy, what was the recipe? It called for white miso paste. And the two of us were like, I don't know what that is. Like, what do you do with it? And it was, you know, $5, and we thought that was a lot of money, and it was like we only needed a tablespoon. And, you know, but she was a trooper, and I still remember that. And then just, yeah, reading cookbooks. I mean, and as you said, we have so many blogs, and now TV shows, right? There's, like, TV shows popping up all over the place. I think 2013 is, like, the year of the vegan show.
Wow.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
And, yeah, there's so many resources now.
You know, it's unfortunate that none of those shows are on the Food Network, though, because – and I don't think they could ever have one because it would invalidate all the other shows on that channel.
You know, I think so much of it would be about presentation. I think that – for better or worse, I think that the subject of veganism or even like that word would have to be used very carefully. But, you know, you talk about plant-based stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I work at a bookstore part-time, and like I can't even tell you how much in the last year the vegan books have just flown off the shelf, and it's all because of people's doctors are sending them in and saying, you need to change the way that you eat. And these people are coming in, they're like, I don't know. Now, if it had a big vegan on the cover, they wouldn't probably be interested. But instead, you know, they're buying, like, the Kind Diet, they're buying Eat to Live, they're buying stuff like that, and they're really excited about it. So, you know, maybe you get people with the health first, and then they're kind of on board with the animal stuff a little bit later.
Well, so, and it's kind of interesting getting back to the TV shows. I was, during the holidays, I was doing some vegan baking, and I was looking at one of the cupcake books, and they were telling the story about how when they went onto the Cupcake Wars TV show and how difficult it was to try to think about how to present the cupcakes and to make the cupcakes and win the contest. It was quite a humorous show, and it seems like there's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes in those shows that you never realize.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's a good thing that they're on, but you don't have much hope that they'd be mainstreamed onto the Food Network either, huh? You're with Greg on that.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's going to happen, and it might not happen this year on the Food Network, but I really, really, truly feel optimistic that a change is coming. I mean, if you run an entire network dedicated to food and you can't dedicate one half hour a week to a vegan show, like, come on, are you kidding me? Like, you can do that.
Yeah, and then there's all these very strange shows of people, like you said, eating all these weird, like baby alligators hatching out of the eggs or whatever.
Or seeing how much they can eat, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, exactly, yeah. If that stuff can exist and find an audience, and then meanwhile you have all the vegans saying, like, we are begging you, please put on a show. You know, like, there's an audience there.
one thing I find really distressful is when I go to the gym and, you know, they have all those TVs on while you're on the bikes or the treadmills or whatever, and it never fails. They have one of those shows where people are, like, gorging themselves with a 49-pound burrito or something, and you're just like, do we have to watch this while we exercise? It would be so nice to have a vegan alternative, something about health and fitness, you know. So I think there is a market, too.
You know, the times are changing. I've been a vegetarian for 35 years and a vegan for the last 14 or 15. And I've really seen a lot of changes over time. Back in the beginnings, I used to be able to get Loma Linda Foods. The Seventh-day Adventists had vegetarian products. Hamburgers came in cans.
Yeah. Veggie burgers in cans. Well, I think you could probably really get real hamburgers in cans still if you look hard enough. Doesn't sound very appetizing, though. You're right. We've come a long way.
A long way. And now in mainstream supermarkets, you can find veggie burgers. And in specialty stores, you can find everything from vegan lamb and vegan shrimp to haggis.
Yeah, I actually don't know if there's, like, a single food I can think of that can be made vegan. And I was actually just discussing this with someone. I was, like, actually, for real, trying to brainstorm and think. And the only thing I can come up with was a hard-boiled egg. But then that even flipped on its head, because the new cookbook that's coming out soon, called Betty Goes Vegan, by the couple who went through the entire Betty Crocker cookbook and veganized every recipe. It's going to be amazing. I got an advanced copy, and the book is coming out very, very soon, and, like, holy cow, it's incredible. But there is in there a vegan hard-boiled egg recipe, and I was like, okay, we're done. Like, there's no excuses now. Like, there's nothing anybody could say.
I've often thought about trying to veganize a deviled egg, and I thought about, you know, the sculpting I would have to do on the tofu. There's also a new product out there called Veg, and it tastes way too much like egg for my taste. I bought a bag of it and used it once and put it back on the shelf. It's way too similar.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it's funny. When I was at a vegetarian Summerfest conference last summer, they had for dinner the one night, I think it was like Gardein, like chicken breast with like sauce on it, or it was some kind of like a fake chicken, and it was so realistic. Like, you could see everybody kind of like biting into it and like looking around the room like, did somebody just pull like the biggest prank on us in the world? Like, what is going on here? I mean, it's almost creepy how realistic stuff can get, but I guess that's a good thing, you know?
Yeah, it'll help people make the transition, I think. The first animal rights conference I went to back in 2002, they had vegan shrimp cocktails, and several people at my table passed them on to me because they were way too realistic.
It does. It freaks you out a little bit.
Jamie, we're running short on time. I really appreciate you being on the show. Let's tell people again where they can go to read your blog or to watch your television show.
Yeah, we have all episodes of the show online on the website, and it's SaveTheKales.com.
It's been great talking with you, Jamie, and best wishes in the future.
This was a lot of fun. I hope to come to Texas sometime and meet you. Thank you.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah,
we'll see you.
Okay, thank you.
Be sure to watch Jamie's show or read her blog to get some ideas about how you can keep your New Year's resolution for a healthier you. That's SaveTheKales.com.
If you'd like to learn more about a vegetarian diet, you can also visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso's website, vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of Animal Concerns of Texas, you'll find them at ktep.org. Just click the Listen button. Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.
Tell me when we gonna wake up. I want to know when we gonna make a change. Gotta be strong. Some things we can.